be brought.
Gratefully, Kira lowered herself onto the nearby bench. She rubbed her throbbing leg with one hand. Across the aisle, she saw Vandara bow. I forgot again, I should have bowed. And then sit, stony-faced. The chief guardian glanced down at his own stack of papers.
There are 5 more charges, he said. We will deal with them and make a decision after the meal.
Food appeared, brought by the door guard. A plate was handed to Kira. She saw and smelled roasted chicken and warm, crusty bread scattered with seeds. She had not eaten anything but raw vegetables in several days, and had not tasted chicken in many months. But she could still hear Vandara's voice, shrill with vindictive accusation.
She eats a lot.
Fearful of the consequences if she showed her ravenous hunger, Kira willed herself to nibble at the tempting meal. Then she set the half-empty plate aside and sipped water from the cup they had brought. Tired, hungry still, and frightened, she stroked the scrap of cloth in her pocket and waited for the next round of accusations. The 12 guardians went elsewhere, leaving through a side door, probably to a private eating place. After a while, guards came to take her food tray away and announced a rest period. The trial would resume when the bell rang twice, they told her. Vandara rose and left the room. Kira waited for a moment. Then she made her way to the door of the council edifice, walked through the long hall, and went outside. The world was unchanged. People came and went, working at various jobs, arguing loudly. She heard shrill voices at the marketplace, women shouting outrage at the prices, vendors shouting in reply. Babies cried, tykes fought. Scavenger dogs growled and menaced each other as they vied for dropped scraps. The boy Matt appeared, running past with some others. When he saw Kira, he hesitated, then stopped and came back.
We got saplings for you, he whispered. Me and some other tykes. We put them in a pile. Later we be starting your cot if you want.
Then he paused, curious.
If you need a cot, that is.
What be happening in there?
So Matt knew about the trial. No surprise. The boy seemed to know everything that was happening in the village. Kira shrugged with feigned nonchalance. She didn't want to let him know how frightened she was.
A lot of talking, she told the boy.
And she be in there, her with the horrid scar.
Kira knew whom he meant.
Yes, she's the accuser.
She's hard, that Vandara. She killed her own tyke, they say. Made him eat the oleander, they say. Sat with him and held his head till he ate it, though he didn't want to.
Kira had heard the story. It was judged an accident, she reminded Matt, though she had her doubts. Other tykes have eaten the oleander. It's a danger having a poisonous plant grow wild everywhere. They ought to pull it all up, not leave it where the tykes can get at it.
Matt shook his head. We be needing it there to teach us, he pointed out. Me, Mum, she slapped at me when I touched it. Slapped my head around so horrid hard I thought my neck would crack. It's how I learnt about the oleander.
Well, the Council of Guardians judged Vandara and said she didn't, Kira said again.
She's a hard one anyways. They say because of the horrid wound. Pain be making her cruel.
Pain made me proud, Kira thought, but didn't say.
When you be finish?
Later today.
We'll work on your cot. Some of my mates'll help.
Thank you, Matt, Kira said. You're a good friend.
He made a face, embarrassed.
You be needing a cot.
He turned to run after the other boys.
And you tell us the stories, after all. You be needing a place for that.
Kira smiled, watching him scamper off. The bell at the top of the council edifice rang twice. She turned to re-enter the building.
She was kept against the rules because her grandfather was still alive and had power, but he is long gone.
Jameson read the next accusation on the list. They had allowed her to sit for the afternoon session, and they told Vandara to sit, too. Kira was grateful.
If Vandara had stood, she would have forced herself to ignore the pain in her leg and stand as well. Again, the guardian who was her defender reiterated that exceptions could be made. By now, frightening though the accusations were, the repetition was tiresome. Kira tried to stay alert. With her hand in her pocket, she fingered the small scrap of woven cloth and pictured its colors in her mind. The community cloth was drab, all no color. The formless shifts and trousers worn by the people were woven and stitched for protection against the sudden occasional rain, thorn scratch, or poison berry. The usual village fabric was not decorated. But Kira's mother had known the art of dye. It was from her stained hands that the colored threads used for rare ornamentation were produced. The robe worn each year by the singer when he performed the ruin song was richly embroidered. The intricate scenes on it had been there for centuries, and the robe had been worn by each singer and passed from one to the next. Once, many years before, Katrina had been asked to replace a few threads that had torn loose. Kira was only a small tyke then, but she remembered standing in the cot's shadowed corner when a guardian brought the fabulous robe and waited while her mother made the small repair. She remembered watching, fascinated, as her mother pushed a bone needle with thick, colorful thread through the fabric. Gradually, a bright gold replaced the small, frayed spot on one sleeve. Then they had taken the robe away again. At that year's gathering, Kira remembered, both she and her mother had peered from their seats at the stage, trying to find the repaired place as the singer moved his arms in gestures during the song. But they were too far away, and the repaired spot was too small. Each year that followed, they had brought the ancient robe again to her mother for small repairs. "One day my daughter will be able to do this," Katrina had said one year to the guardian. "Look what she has done," she said, and showed him the scrap that Kira had just completed, the one that had composed itself so magically in her fingers. "She has a skill far greater than mine." Kira had stood silently, embarrassed but proud, as the guardian examined the threading she had done. He made no comment, simply nodded, and returned the small piece to her. But his eyes had been bright with interest, she could see. Each year following, he had asked to see her work. Kira always stood at her mother's side, never touching the fragile ancient cloth, marveling each time at the rich hues that told the history of the world. Golds and reds and browns, and here and there, faded pale, almost reduced to white, there had once been blue. Her mother showed her the faded places that remained of it. Her mother did not know how to make blue. Sometimes they talked of it, Kira and Katrina, looking at the huge upturned bowl of sky above their world. "If only I could make blue," her mother said. "I've heard that somewhere there is a special plant." She looked out at her own garden, thick with the flowers and shoots from which she could create the golds and greens and pinks, and shook her head in yearning for the one color she could not create. Now her mother was dead. Now her mother is dead. Kira startled herself out of the daydreamed memory. Someone was saying those words. She made herself listen. "And now her mother is dead. There's even reason to think that her mother may have carried an illness that will endanger others, and the women need the space where their cot was. There is no room for this useless girl. She can't marry. No one wants a cripple. She takes up space and food, and she causes problems with the discipline of the tykes, telling them stories, teaching them games so that they make noise and disrupt the work." It dragged on. The repetitions of Vandara's accusations were recited, and the defender again and again reiterated the amendment that said exceptions could be made. But Kira noted a change of tone. It was subtle, but she perceived a difference. Something had taken place among the Council of Guardians when the members had withdrawn during lunch. She saw Vandara shift uneasily in her seat and knew that her accuser noticed the difference too. Kira, clutching the cloth talisman in her pocket, became aware suddenly that its warmth and comfort had returned. During her infrequent leisure times, Kira often experimented with colored bits of threadings, feeling the excitement in her fingers as her surprising skill grew. She used bits of discarded woven cloth from the weaving shed. It was not a violation. She had asked permission to take the scraps to her cot. Sometimes, pleased with what she had done, she showed her work to her mother and received a proud, quick smile of approval. But more often, her efforts were disappointments, the uneven products of a girl still learning. Usually she threw her experiments away. This one, the one she held now in the nervous fingers of her right hand, she had done as her mother lay ill. Seated helplessly by the side of the dying woman, Kira leaned forward again and again to hold a container of water to her mother's lips. She smoothed her mother's hair, rubbed her cold feet, and held the trembling hands, knowing there was nothing more she could do. While her mother slept restlessly, Kira sorted the dyed threads in her basket and began to weave them into the cloth scrap with a bone needle. It soothed her to do so and passed the time. The threads began to sing to her, not a song of words or tones, but a pulsing, a quivering in her hands as if they had life. For the first time, her fingers did not direct the threads, but followed where they led. She was able to close her eyes and simply feel the needle move through the fabric, pulled by the urgent, vibrating threads. When her mother murmured, Kira leaned forward with the water container and moistened the dry lips. Only then did she look down at the small strip of material in her lap. It was radiant. Despite the dim light in the cot, it was night start by then. The golds and reds pulsated as if the morning sun itself had slid and twisted its rays into the cloth. The brilliant threads crisscrossed in an intricate pattern of loops and knots that Kira had never seen before, that she could not have created, that she had never known or heard described. When her mother's eyes opened for a final time, Kira had held the vibrant piece of fabric so that the dying woman could see. Words were beyond Katrina by then, but she smiled. Now, secret in her hand, the cloth seemed to speak a silent, pulsing message to Kira. It told her there was danger still, but it told her also that she was to be saved. Chapter 5. Kira noticed for the first time that a large box had been placed on the floor behind the seats of the Council of Guardians. It had not been there before the lunchtime break. As she and Vandara watched, one of the guards, responding to a nod from the chief guardian, lifted the box to the table and raised its lid. Her defender, Jameson, removed and unfolded something that she recognized immediately.
"The singer's robe," Kira spoke aloud in delight.
"This has no relevance," Vandara muttered, but she too was leaning forward to see. The magnificent robe was laid out on the table in display. Ordinarily it was seen only once a year, at the time when the village gathered to hear the ruin song, the lengthy history of their people. Most citizens, crowded into the auditorium for the occasion, saw the singer's robe only from a distance. They shoved and pushed, trying to nudge closer for a look. But Kira knew the robe well from watching her mother's meticulous work on it each year. A guardian had always stood nearby, attentive. Warned not to touch, Kira had watched, marveling at her mother's skill, at her ability to choose just the right shade.
There, on the left shoulder.
Kira remembered that spot, where just last year some threads had pulled and torn, and her mother had carefully coaxed the broken threads free. Then she had selected pale pinks, slightly darker roses, and other colors darkening to crimson, each hue only a hint deeper than the one before, and she had stitched them into place, blending them flawlessly into the edges of the elaborate design. Jameson watched Kira as she remembered. Then he said, "Your mother had been teaching you the art." Kira nodded.
since I was small, she acknowledged aloud.
Your mother was a skilled worker. Her dyes were steadfast. They have not faded.
She was careful, Kira said, and thorough.
We're told that your skill is greater than hers.
So they knew. I still have much to learn, Kira said.
And she taught you the coloring as well as the stitches?
Kira nodded because she knew he expected her to, but it was not exactly true. Her mother had planned to teach her the art of the dyes, but the time had not yet come before the illness struck. She tried to be honest in her answer. She was beginning to teach me, Kira said. She told me that she had been taught by a woman named Annabelle.
Annabella now, Jameson said.
Kira was startled. She is still alive? And four syllables?
She's very old. Her sight is somewhat diminished, but she can still be used as a resource.
Resource for what? But Kira stayed silent. The scrap in her pocket was warm against her hand.
Suddenly Vandara stood. I request that these proceedings continue, she said abruptly and harshly. This is a delaying tactic on the part of the defender.
The chief guardian rose. Around him, the other guardians, who'd been murmuring among themselves, fell silent. His voice, directed at Vandara, was not unkind.
You may go, he said. The proceedings are complete. We have reached our decision.
Vandara stood silent, unmoving. She glared at him defiantly. The chief guardian nodded, and two guards moved forward to escort her from the room.
I have a right to know your decision,
Vandara shouted, her face twisted with rage. She wrested her arms free of the guard's grasp and faced the Council of Guardians.
Actually, the chief guardian said in a calm voice, you have no rights at all, but I'm going to tell you the decision so that there will be no misunderstanding. The orphan girl Kira will stay. She will have a new role.
He gestured toward the singer's robe, still spread out on the table.
Kira, he said, looking at her, you will continue your mother's work. You will go beyond her work, actually, since your skill is far greater than hers was. First, you will repair the robe, as your mother always did. Next, you will restore it. Then your true work will begin. You will complete the robe.
He gestured toward the large, undecorated expanse of fabric across the shoulders. He raised one eyebrow, looking at her as if he were asking a question. Nervously, Kira nodded in reply and bowed slightly.
As for you?
The chief guardian looked again at Vandara, who stood sullenly between the guards. He spoke politely to her.
You have not lost. You demanded the girl's land, and you may have it, you and the other women. Build your pen. It would be wise to pen your tykes. They are troublesome and should be better contained. Go now, he commanded.
Vandara turned. Her face was a mask of fury. She shrugged away the hands of the guards, leaned forward, and whispered harshly to Kira.
You will fail. Then they will kill you.
She smiled coldly at Jameson.
So, that's it then, she said. The girl is yours.
She stalked down the aisle and went through the broad door. The chief guardian and the other council members ignored the outburst, as if it were merely an annoying insect that had finally been swatted away. Someone was refolding the singer's robe. Kira, Jameson said. Go and gather what you need, whatever you want to bring with you. Be back here when the bell rings four times, and we will take you to your quarters, to the place where you will live from now on. Puzzled, Kira waited a moment, but there were no other instructions. The guardians were straightening their papers and collecting their books and belongings. They seemed to have forgotten she was there. Finally, she stood, straightened herself against her walking stick, and limped from the room.
Emerging from the council edifice into bright sunlight and the usual chaos of the village central plaza, she realized that it was still mid-afternoon, still an ordinary day in the existence of the people, and that no one's life had changed except her own. The summer start day was hot. Near the edifice steps, a crowd had gathered to watch a pig slaughter behind the butchers. After the choice parts were sold, scraps would be thrown. People and dogs together would shove and grab. The smell from the thick mounds of excrement beneath the terrified pigs and the high-pitched squeals of terror as they awaited death made Kira feel dizzy and nauseated. She hurried around the edge of the throng, making her way toward the weaving shed.
"You're out! What happened? Do you go to the field? To the beasts?"
Matt was calling to her in excitement. Kira smiled. His curiosity appealed to her. It matched her own. And behind his wildness, he had a kind heart, she thought. She remembered how he had acquired his pet, his little companion dog. It had been a useless stray, underfoot, scavenging everywhere for food. On a rainy afternoon, it had been caught and tossed by the wheel of a passing donkey cart. Badly injured, the dog lay bleeding in the mud and would have been left to die unnoticed. But the boy hid it in nearby shrubbery until its wounds had mended. Kira had watched from the weaving shed each day as Matt stealthily crept in to feed the animal while it lay healing. Now the dog, lively and in good health despite a tail as crooked and useless as Kira's leg, stayed constantly at Matt's side. He called it Branch, named for the small tree part he had used to splint its damaged tail. Kira reached down and scratched the homely mongrel behind his ear.
"I'm let go," she told the boy.
His eyes widened. Then he grinned.
"So we still be getting stories, me and my mates," he said with satisfaction. "I seen Vandara," Matt added. "She come out like this."
He scampered to the steps of the edifice and stalked down them, face haughty. Kira smiled at the imitation.
"She be hating you now for certain," Matt added cheerfully.
"Well, they gave her my piece of land," Kira told him, "so she and the others can make a pen for their tykes the way they wanted. I hope you didn't already start on a new cot for me," she added, remembering that he had offered.
Matt grinned.
"We didn't start yet," he said. "Soon we would have. But if you be sent to the beasts, then there be no need."
He paused, rubbing Branch with his dirty bare foot.
"Where are you to live, then?"
Kira slapped at a mosquito on her arm. She rubbed at the little smear of blood from its bite.
"I don't know," she admitted. "They told me to come back to the edifice when the bell rings 4. I'm to gather my things."
She laughed a little.
"I don't have much to gather. My things were mostly burned."
Matt grinned.
"I saved you some things," he told her happily. "I filched them from your cot before the burning. Didn't tell you before. I waited to see what be happening to you."
Down the path, beyond the pig slaughter, Matt's mates called to him to hurry and join them.
"Me and Branch must go along now," he said. "But I be bringing the things to you when the bells go 4. To the steps, I."
"Thank you, Matt. I'll meet you at the steps."
Smiling, Kira watched him go, his thin, scabbed legs churning in the dusty path as he ran to join his friends. Beside him, Branch scampered, his broken stub of a tail wagging crookedly. Kira continued on through the crowds, past the food shops and the noise of bickering, bargaining women. Dogs barked. A pair of them snarled, facing each other with bared teeth in the path, a dropped morsel between them. Nearby, a curly-headed tyke eyed both dogs warily, then deftly leaped between them, seized the bit of food, and stuffed it into his own mouth. His mother, intent on her business at a nearby shop, glanced around, saw the tyke near the dogs, and seized him away, yanking at his arm and administering a sharp slap to his head when he was back at her side. The tyke smirked, chewing eagerly at whatever he had picked up from the path. The weaving shed was farther along, mercifully in a shady area surrounded by large trees. It was quieter there and cooler, though the mosquitoes were more numerous. The women in the shed, seated at looms, nodded to Kira as she approached.
"There's plenty scraps to gather,"
one called and gestured with her head as her hands continued work.
It was the job that Kira usually did, the tidying up. She was not permitted to weave yet, though she had always watched carefully how it was done and thought that she could have, if they needed her. She had not been at the weaving shed in many days, not since her mother's illness and death. So much had happened, so much had changed. She assumed that she would not be returning now that her status seemed different. But because they had called to her in a friendly way, Kira moved through the shed, through the clatter of the wooden looms at work, and picked up the scraps from the floor. One loom was silent, she noticed. No one was working there today. Fourth from the end, she counted. Usually Camilla was there. She paused by the empty loom and waited until a nearby worker had stopped to reset her shuttle.
"Where's Camilla?" Kira asked curiously.
Sometimes, of course, the women left briefly to wed, to give birth, or simply assigned to some other temporary task. The weaver glanced over, her hands still occupied. Her feet began to move again on the treadle. She fell, took a clumsy fall, over at the stream. She gestured with her head. Doing washing. The rocks were mossy.
Yes, it's slippery there.
Kira knew. She had slipped herself sometimes at the stream, at the washing place. The woman shrugged. She broke her arm real bad. Can't be fixed. Can't be made straight. No more good for weaving. Her hubby tried real hard to straighten up the arm, 'cause he needs her, for the tykes and such. But she'll probably go to the field.
Kira shuddered, imagining the torturing pain of the broken arm as the hubby tried to pull it into a healing shape.
She has 5 tykes, Camilla does. Now she can't care for them or work. They'll be given away. You want one?
The woman grinned at Kira. She had few teeth.
Kira shook her head. She smiled wanly and continued down the aisle between the looms. You want her loom? The woman called after her. They'll be needing somebody to take it. You're probably ready to weave.
But Kira shook her head again. She had wanted to weave, once. The weaving women had always been kind to her, but her future seemed different now. The looms clattered on. From the shade of the shed, Kira noticed that the sun was lower in the sky. It would soon be the ringing of 4 bells. She nodded goodbye to the weaving women and headed back along the path toward the place where she had lived with her mother, the place where her cot had long stood, the place of the only home she had ever known. She felt a need to say goodbye.
Chapter 6. The huge bell in the tower of the council edifice began to ring. The bell governed the people's lives. It told them when to begin work and when to stop, when to gather for meetings, when to prepare for a hunt, celebrate an event, or arm for danger. 4 bells, the 3rd was resonating now, meant that the day's business could end. For Kira, it meant the time to report to the Council of Guardians. She hurried toward the central plaza through the crowds of people leaving their workplaces. Matt was waiting on the steps, as he'd promised. Branch, beside him, was pawing excitedly at a large, iridescent beetle, blocking its path again and again with a paw, as the beetle tried unsuccessfully to waddle by. The dog looked up and wagged its crooked tail when Kira called a greeting.
"What you got?" Matt asked, looking at the small bundle Kira carried on her back.
"Not much," she laughed ruefully. "But I had stored a few things in the clearing, so they missed the burning. My basket of threads and some scraps of cloth. And look at this, Matt."
She reached into her pocket and held up a lumpy oblong.
"I found my soap, where I left it on a rock. Good thing, because I don't know how to make it, and I have no coins to buy any."
Then she laughed, realizing that Matt, grimy and unkempt, felt no need of soap. She supposed Matt had a mother somewhere, and usually mothers scrubbed their tykes now and then, but she had never known Matt clean.
"Here, I brung these." Matt indicated a pile of objects wrapped haphazardly in a dirty woven cloth on the step near him. "Some things I took before the burning, for you to have if and they let you stay."
"Thank you, Matt." Kira wondered what he had chosen to rescue.
But you will not be carrying it because of your horrid gimp, he said, referring to her crippled leg. So I'll be your carrier once they tells you where you're to be. That way I'll know, too. Kira liked the idea of Matt coming with her and knowing where she would live. It made everything seem less strange. Wait here, then, she told him. I must go inside, and they'll show me where I'll be living. Then I'll come back for you. I have to hurry, Matt, because the bells have finished, and they told me to come at 4 bells.
Me and Branch can wait. I've got me a sucker I filched from a shop, Matt said, pulling a dirt-encrusted candy from his pocket. And Branch, him always loves a mammoth buggy to poke like now.
The dog's ears shot up at the sound of his name, but his eyes never left the beetle on the step. Kira hurried inside the council edifice while the boy waited on the steps. Only Jameson was in the large room waiting for her. She wondered if, having been appointed her defender at the trial, he was now to be her overseer. Oddly, she felt a little twinge of irritation. She was old enough to manage alone. Many girls her age were preparing for marriage. She had always known she would not marry. Her twisted leg made it an impossibility. She could never be a good wife, could never perform the many duties required. But certainly she could manage alone. Her mother had, and had taught her. But he nodded in welcome, and her brief irritation faded and was forgotten. "There you are," Jameson said. He rose and folded the papers he'd been reading. "I'll show you to your quarters. It isn't far. It's in a wing of this building." Then he looked at her, and at the small bundle she carried on her back. "Is that all you have?" he asked. She was glad that he had inquired, because it gave her the opportunity to mention Matt.
"Not quite," Kira told him, "but I can't carry much because of..."
She gestured toward her leg. Jameson nodded.
"So I have a boy who helps me. His name is Matt. I hope you don't mind, but he's waiting on the steps. He has my other things. I was hoping that maybe you would let him continue as my helper. He's a good boy."
Jameson frowned slightly. Then he turned and called to one of the guards. "Get the boy from the steps," he said. Kira interrupted. Both Jameson and the guard turned. She felt awkward and spoke apologetically. She even felt herself bow slightly.
"He has a dog," she said in a low voice. "He won't go any place without his dog. It's quite small," she added in a whisper.
Jameson looked at her impatiently, as if he were suddenly aware what a burden she was going to be. Finally, he sighed. "Bring the dog, too," he told the guard. The three of them were led down a corridor. They were an odd trio, with Kira first, stumbling against her stick, dragging her leg with its broom sound, swish, swish. Then Matt, silent for a change, his eyes wide, taking in the grandeur of the surroundings. And finally, toenails tip-tapping against the tiled floor, the bent-tailed dog happily carrying a squirming beetle in his mouth. Matt put the bundle of Kira's belongings down on the floor just inside the doorway, but he wouldn't step inside the room. He took in everything solemnly with his wide-eyed, observant gaze, and made the decision himself.
"Me and Branch will wait out here," he announced. "What this be called?" he asked, looking round the wide space where he stood.
"The corridor," Jameson told him. Matt nodded.
"Me and Branch, we just be waiting here in this corridor, then. Me and Branch, we don't go in the room because of the wee buggies."
Kira looked over quickly, but the beetle had been consumed now. Anyway, the beetle had not been wee. Matt himself had described it as mammoth.
"Wee buggies?"
Jameson was the one who inquired, his brow furrowed.
"Branch got fleas," Matt explained, looking at the floor.
Jameson shook his head. Kira saw his lips twitch in amusement. He led her into the room. She was astonished. The cot where she had lived all of her life with her mother had been a simple, dirt-floored hut.
Their beds had been straw-filled pallets on raised wooden shelves. Handmade utensils had held their belongings and food. They had always eaten together at a wooden table that Kira's father had made long before her birth. She mourned the table after the burning because of the memories it held for her mother. Katrina had described his strong hands smoothing the wood and rounding its corners so that the coming baby would not be endangered by sharp edges. All of it was ashes now, the smooth wood, the soft edges, the memory of his hands. This room had several tables, skillfully made, carved and delicate. And the bed was wood, on legs, covered with lightly woven bed coverings. Kira had never seen such a bed, and supposed the raised legs were to make one safe from beasts or bugs. Yet surely there were none here in the council edifice. Even Matt had sensed that and consigned his dog's fleas to the corridor. There were windows with glass, and through them she could see the tops of trees. The room faced the forest behind the building. Jameson opened a door inside the room, and Kira saw a smaller room, windowless, lined with wide drawers.
"The singer's robe is kept here," he told her.
He opened one large drawer slightly, and she saw the folded robe with its bright threaded colors. He closed it again and gestured toward the other, smaller drawers.
"Supplies," he said. "Whatever you need."
He moved back into the bedroom and opened a door on the other side. She caught a glimpse of what at first seemed flat stones. It was a floor of pale green tile.
"There's water here," he explained, "for washing and all your needs."
Water? Inside a building? Jameson went to the doorway and glanced out to where Matt and Branch waited. Matt was squatting on the floor and sucking on his stick of candy.
"If you want the boy to stay with you, you could wash him here. The dog, too. There is a tub."
Matt heard him and looked up toward Kira in dismay.
"No, me and Branch, we be going now," he said.
Then with an expression of concern, he asked,
"You don't be captive here, do you?"
"No, she's not a captive," Jameson reassured Matt. "Why would you think that?"
"Your supper will be brought," he told Kira. "You're not alone here. The carver lives down the hall on the other side." He gestured with his hand to a closed door.
"The carver? Do you mean the boy named Thomas?"
Kira was startled.
"He lives here too?"
"Yes. You are welcome to visit his room. You must both work during the daylight hours, but you may take your meals with the carver. Familiarize yourself with your quarters now and your tools. Get some rest. Tomorrow I will go over your work assignment with you."
"I'll lead the boy and the dog out now."
She stood in the open doorway and watched them retreat down the long corridor, the man leading the way, Matt walking jauntily just behind him, and the dog at Matt's heels. The boy looked back at her, waved slightly, and grinned with a questioning look. His face, smeared with the sticky candy, was alight with excitement. She knew that within minutes he would be telling his mates that he'd barely escaped being washed. His dog, too, and all the fleas. A close call. Quietly, she closed the door and looked around. Kira found it hard to sleep. So much was strange. Only the moon was familiar. Tonight it was almost full, flooding her new living space with silvery light through the glass of her windows. On such a night, back in her other life, in the windowless cot with her mother, she might have risen to enjoy the moonlight. On some moonlit nights, she and her mother slipped outside and stood together in the breeze, slapping at mosquitoes and watching the clouds slide past the bright globe in the night sky. Here, through a slightly opened window, night breeze and moonlight entered her room together. The moonlight slipped over the table in the corner and washed across the polished wooden floor. She saw her sandals paired beside the chair where she had sat to remove them. She saw her walking stick leaning in the corner, its shadow outlined on the wall. She saw the shapes of the objects on the table, the things that Matt had brought, bundled to her. She wondered how he had chosen. Perhaps it had been rushed, with the fire starting, perhaps he'd simply grabbed what he could with his impetuous, generous, small hands. There was her threading frame. She thanked Matt in her mind. He had known what the frame meant to her. Dried herbs in a small basket. Kira was glad to have those and hoped she could remember which was to be used for what. Not that the herbs had been of any value to her mother when the terrible sickness came, but for the small things, an ache in the shoulder, a bite that festered and swelled, the herbs were helpful then. And she was happy to have the basket. She remembered her mother weaving it from river grass. Some chunky tubers. Kira smiled, picturing Matt grabbing food, probably nibbling while he was at it. She would not need those now. The meal brought to her on a tray in the evening had been hearty. Thick bread and a soup made of meat and barley with greens throughout, and flavored strongly with herbs she savored but didn't recognize. She had eaten it from a glazed earthen bowl, using a spoon carved from bone, and then wiped her mouth and hands with a folded, fine-woven cloth. No meal had ever been so elegant for Kira, or so lonely. In the little arrangement of things were folded pieces of her mother's clothing, a thick shawl with a fringe at the edge, and a skirt stained from the dyes her mother used, so that the simple, unadorned fabric seemed decorated with streaks of color. Sleepily thinking of her mother's stained skirt, Kira imagined how she could use her threads to outline the bright streaks of color, so that with skill and time, it would take time, she could recreate it into a costume suitable for some celebration. Not that there had ever been anything for her to celebrate, but maybe this, her new quarters, her new job, the fact that her life had been spared. Kira tossed restlessly on the bed. She felt an object at her neck. It, too, had been in the bundle that Matt brought, and she treasured it most of the things he had saved. It was the pendant that her mother had always worn, dangling from a leather thong, not visible, under her clothing. Kira knew of it, had touched and stroked it often as a small tyke still breastfed. It was a shiny section of rock, split cleanly down one side, but studded with shiny purple on the other, and with a hole to allow for the thong. A simple but unusual thing, it had been a gift from Kira's father, and Katrina had cherished it as a kind of talisman. Kira had lifted it from her mother's neck when she was ill, in order to wash the fevered body, and had placed it on the shelf near the basket of herbs. Matt must have found it there. Wearing it now around her own neck, Kira lifted it against her cheek, hoping to recapture a feeling of her mother, perhaps the smell of her, herbs and dyes and dried blossoms. But the little rock was inert and odorless, without a hint or memory of life. In contrast, the scrap of cloth from Kira's pocket, the one which had created itself so magically in her fingers, fluttered where it lay near her head. Perhaps the night breeze through the open window had made it move. For a moment, Kira, watching the moonlight and thinking of her mother, didn't notice. Then she saw the cloth tremble slightly, as if it had life in the pale light. She smiled, and the thought crossed her mind that it was like Matt's little dog, looking up, twitching its ears, wagging its woeful tail, hoping to be noticed. She reached out and touched the cloth. Feeling its warmth in her hand, Kira closed her eyes. A cloud shadowed the moon, and the room darkened. Finally, she slept, without dreams, and in the morning when Kira woke, the little cloth was limp, no more than a wrinkled scrap of pretty fabric in her bed. Chapter 7 An egg. That was a treat. In addition to the boiled egg, her breakfast tray contained more of the thick bread and a bowl of warm cereal swimming in cream. Kira yawned and ate. Usually, at waking, she and her mother had walked to the stream. Here, she supposed, the green-tiled room took its place. But Kira was nervous about the room. She had entered it the night before and turned the various gleaming handles. Some of the water was hot and startled her. It must be for cooking. Somewhere below, a fire had apparently been built. Somehow, the cooking water had been hoisted here, but what was she to do with it? There was no need for her to cook, Kira thought this morning, as she had last night. Warm, prepared food had been brought. Mystified still, Kira turned her attention this morning to the long, low tub. Jameson had suggested that she could wash Matt there. There was something that looked and smelled like soap. Leaning forward over the tub's rim, she tried to wash, but the procedure was awkward and unnatural. It was easier in the stream. And she could wash her clothes in the stream and hang them on the bushes. Here, in this small, windowless room, there was no place to dry anything. No breeze, no sun. It was interesting, Kira decided, that they had found a way for water to enter the building, but impractical and unsanitary, and there was no place to bury waste. She wiped the cold water from her face and hands with the cloth she found in the tiled room and decided that she would return to the stream each day to attend to her needs properly. She dressed quickly, laced her sandals, pulled the wooden comb through her long hair, grabbed her stick, and hurried through the empty corridor to leave her new home and go for a morning walk. But before she'd gone very far, a door in the corridor opened. A boy she recognized emerged and spoke to her. "Kira the Threader," he said. "They told me you'd come." "You're the Carver," she said. "Jameson told me you were here."
"Yes, I'm Thomas."
He grinned at her. He seemed about her age, not long into two syllables, and was a good-looking boy with clear skin and bright eyes. His hair was thick and reddish-brown. A chip in one front tooth showed when he smiled. "This is where I live," he explained. He opened the door wider so that she could see inside. His room was just like hers, though on this, the opposite side of the corridor, his window view was to the wide central square. She noticed, too, that his room seemed more of a lived-in place. His things were strewn around. "This is my workroom, too," he gestured, and she could see a large table with his carving tools and scraps of wood. "And there's a storage room for supplies," he pointed.
"Yes, mine's the same," Kira told him. "My supply room has lots of drawers. I haven't started work yet, but there's a table under the windows, and the light is good there. I think that's where I'll do the threading."
"And there, that door, that's your cooking water in your tub?" Kira asked him.
"Do you use it? It seems such a bother when the stream's so nearby."
"The tenders will show you how it works," he explained.
"Tenders?"
"The one who brought you your food? That's a tender. They'll help you however you want, and a guardian will be checking on you every day." Good. Thomas seemed to know how things worked. It would be a help, Kira thought, because it all seemed so new, so foreign.
"Have you lived here a long time?" she asked politely.
"Yes," he replied, "since I was quite young."
"How did it happen that you came here?"
The boy frowned, thinking back. "I had just begun carving. I was a very little tyke, but somehow I had discovered that if I took a sharp tool and a piece of wood, I could make pictures. Everyone thought it was quite amazing." He laughed. "I guess it was." Kira laughed a little too, but she was remembering herself, very small, finding that her fingers had a kind of magic to them when she held the colored threads, seeing her mother's astonishment and the look on the face of the guardian. It must have been the same, she thought, for this boy. "Somehow the guardians heard about my work. They came to our cot and admired it."
So similar, Kira thought.
"Then," Thomas continued, "not long after, my parents were both killed during a storm, struck by lightning both at once."
Kira was shocked. She had heard of trees felled by lightning, but not people. The people didn't go out during thunderstorms. "Were you there? How did you stay safe?"
"No, I was alone at the cot. My parents were doing an errand of some sort. I remember that a messenger had been sent for them, but then some guardians came and got me and told me of their deaths. It was fortunate that they knew of me and felt that my work was of value, even though I was still small. Otherwise, I would have simply been given away. But instead, they brought me here. I've been here ever since."
He gestured around the room. For a long time I practiced and learned, and I've made ornaments for many of the guardians. Now, though, I do real work, important work. He pointed, and she could see that a long piece of wood was resting against the table, leaning in the same way that she leaned her walking stick. But this stick was intricately decorated, and from the shavings on the table she could tell that the boy had been working on it. "They've given me wonderful tools," Thomas told her. Outside, the bell rang. Kira was disconcerted. Back in the cot, the sound of the bell meant that it was time to go to work. "Should I go back to my quarters?" she asked. "I was going to walk to the stream." Thomas shrugged. "It doesn't matter. You can do whatever you want. There are no real rules, only that you are required to do the work you were brought here for. They'll check on your work every day. I'm going out now to visit my mother's sister. She has a new tyke, a girl. Look, I'm taking a toy." He reached into his pocket and showed Kira an intricately carved bird. It was hollow. He held it to his mouth and made it whistle. "I made it yesterday," he explained. "It took time for my regular work, but not much. It was easy to do." "I'll be back for lunch," he added, "because I have work to do this afternoon. Shall I bring my lunch tray to your quarters so that we can eat together?" Kira agreed happily. "And look," he said, "here comes the tender who'll pick up the morning trays. She's very nice. You ask her. No, wait. I'll ask her." While Kira watched curiously, Thomas approached the tender and spoke briefly to her. She nodded. "You follow her back to your quarters, Kira," Thomas said. "You don't need to go to the stream. She'll explain the bathroom to you. See you at lunch." He put the little carved bird into his pocket, closed the door to his room, and headed down the corridor. Kira followed the tender back the way she had come. Jameson came to her room shortly after lunch. Thomas had eaten and hurried away to his quarters to resume work. Kira had just gone into the small room lined with drawers and slid open the one containing the singer's robe. She had not yet unfolded it. She had never been permitted to touch it before, and was in awe now and a little nervous. She was staring down at the lavishly decorated fabric, remembering her mother's deft hands holding the bone needle, when she heard the knock on her door, and then heard Jameson come in. "Ah," he said, "the robe."
"I was thinking that I must soon begin my duties," Kira told him, "but I'm almost afraid to start. This is so new to me."
He lifted the robe from the drawer and carried it to the table by the window. There in the light, the colors were even more magnificent, and Kira felt even more inadequate. "Are you comfortable here? You slept well? They brought your food? It was good?"
So many questions. Kira considered whether to tell him how restlessly she had slept, and decided against it. She glanced at the bed to see if the bed coverings would reveal her tossing, and noticed for the first time that someone, probably the tender who brought and took away the food, had smoothed everything so that there was no sign that the bed had been used at all.
"Yes," she told Jameson. "Thank you. And I met Thomas the carver. He ate his lunch with me. It was nice to have someone to talk to."
"And the tender explained things I needed to know," she added. "I thought the hot water was for cooking. I never used hot water just for washing before."
He wasn't paying attention to her embarrassed explanation about the bathroom. He was looking carefully at the robe, sliding his hand across the fabric. "Your mother made minor repairs each year, but now it must all be restored. This is your job."
Kira nodded. "I understand," she said, though she didn't, not really.
"This is the entire story of our world. We must keep it intact, more than intact." She saw that his hand had moved and was stroking the wide, unadorned section of fabric, the section of the cloth that fell across the singer's shoulders. "The future will be told here," he said. "Our world depends upon the telling." "Your supplies, they're adequate?" "There is much to be done here."
"Supplies?"
Kira remembered that she had brought a basket of her own threads. Looking now at the magnificent robe, she knew that her sparse collection, a few leftover colored threads that her mother had allowed her to use for her own, was not adequate at all. Even if she had the skill, and she was not at all certain that she did, she could never restore the robe with what she had brought. Then she remembered the drawers that she had not yet opened.
"I haven't looked yet," she confessed.
She went to the shallow drawers that he had pointed out to her yesterday. They were filled with rolled, white threads in many different widths and textures. There were needles of all sizes and cutting tools laid neatly in a row.
Kira's heart sank. She had hoped that perhaps the threads would already be dyed.
Glancing back at the robe on the table, at its wide array of hues, she felt overwhelmed. If only her mother's threads had been saved. But they were gone, all burned. She bit her lip and looked nervously at Jameson.
"They're not colored," she murmured.
"You said your mother had been teaching you to dye," he reminded her. Kira nodded. She had implied that, but it had not been completely true. Her mother had planned to teach her.
"I still have much to learn," she confessed.
"I learn quickly," she added, hoping that it didn't sound vain. Jameson looked at her with a slight frown. "I will send you to Annabella," he told her. "She's far in the woods, but the path is safe, and she can finish the teaching that your mother started." "The ruin song is not until autumn start," he pointed out. "That's still several months away. The singer won't need the robe until then. You'll have plenty of time." Kira nodded uncertainly. Jameson had been her defender. Now it seemed he was her advisor. Kira was grateful for his help. Still, she sensed an edge, an urgency to his voice that had not been there before. When he left her room, after pointing out a cord on the wall that she could pull if she needed anything, Kira looked again at the robe displayed on the table. So many colors. So many shades of each color. Despite his reassurance, autumn start was not that far away. Today, Kira decided, she would examine the robe and plan. Tomorrow, first thing, she would find Annabella and plead for help. Chapter 8. Matt wanted to come.
"You'll be needing me and Branch for protectors," he said. "Them woods is full of fierce creatures."
Kira laughed.
"Protectors? You? Me and Branchy, us is tough," Matt said. He flexed what passed for muscles in his scrawny arms. "I only look wee."
"Jameson said it was safe, as long as we stay on the path," Kira reminded the boy. Secretly, she thought it would be fun to have both of them, boy and dog, for company.
"But suppose you was to get lost," Matt said. "Me and Branch can find our way out of anywheres. You be needing us for certain if and you get lost."
"But I'll be gone all day, you'll get hungry."
Triumphantly, Matt pulled a thick wad of bread from the voluminous pocket of his baggy shorts.
"Filched this crusty from the baker," he announced with pride.
So the boy won, to Kira's delight, and she had company for the journey into the forest. It was about an hour's walk. Jameson was correct. There seemed to be no danger. Although thick trees shaded the path and they could hear rustling in the undergrowth and unfamiliar cries of strange forest birds, nothing seemed threatening. Now and then Branch chased a small rodent or nosed about an opening in the earth, frightening whatever small animal made its home there.
"Probably there be snakies all in here," Matt told her with a mischievous smile.
"I'm not afraid of snakes."
"Most girls be."
"Not me. There were always small snakes in my mother's garden. She said they were friends to the plants. They ate bugs."
"Like Branchy. Look, he catched him one now."
Matt pointed. His dog had pounced upon an unlucky creature with long, thin legs.
"That be called a daddy long legs."
"Daddy long legs?" Kira laughed. She'd not heard the name before.
"Do you have a father?"
she asked the boy curiously.
Nah, did once, but now me mum is all I got.
What happened to your father?
He shrugged. Dunno. In the fen, he added, things is different. Many gots no pa. And then the gots them, they be scared of them 'cause they hit something horrid.
Me mum hits too,